You are listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Ancient tools and burials, plants and seeds, Neanderthals. All these things we make no apology for the study of archaeology. But we don't do dinosaurs. No, we don't do.
Hey everyone, and welcome to the Archaeological Fantasies Podcast, episode 32. I'm your host, Sarah, with my co-host, Ken Fader. And today we're talking about the Mena Mounds. What are they? Who built them? Why are they here? What about giant rodents? Get ready to think critically.
Digging in a trench, monuments, going to the pub when the day is spent.
Hey everyone, welcome back. How are you doing, Ken?
I'm doing just great, Sarah. How are you?
I'm good. And today we are going to discuss a interesting phenomena that happens all over the world, but here in America we call them Mena Mounds. And they're interesting. We did our homework on these, didn't we?
A little bit, yeah. I mean, and for anybody listening to the podcast, if you want, there's actually a national monument or something.
Yeah, you can go hike around the Mena Mounds.
Where is it? In Washington State, I guess.
Yeah, Washington State.
But these particular features are not unique to that spot. They are found in a lot of places in the United States and, as you say, around the world.
Yeah.
And they're really pretty cool, huh?
Yeah, they're large mound things, I guess, earthworks, but they're not man-made. I think some of the numbers I was seeing was they're 60 to 70 feet wide, and then they're somewhere between 3 to 5 feet tall.
Yeah, and they're circular at the base.
Yes.
And they're kind of like conical mounds.
Yeah.
And I think we've talked about the mounds of the American Midwest. These are the burial mounds, for example, that are found in Ohio and Illinois and Indiana, scattered throughout the Midwest. And those were built by the Adena or the Hopewell people. And we're looking at something starting a little more than 2,000 years ago. And these, when they're excavated by archaeologists, where they have been, invariably there are human burials found in there with grave goods, grave offerings, sometimes in the center or the bottom center. There's a crypt made of logs in which the obviously very important person who was warranted that kind of treatment and death was buried.
And with burial mounds, especially in the Americas, there's always evidence that they were constructed by people. Even if when they are not burial mounds, there's always something left behind, bits of basket, bits of broken pottery, jumbled up crap from the building process.
Really, what's really cool is I've seen photographs of this. In some cases, when people are producing mounds, they're doing this one basket load at a time.
Because
these folks don't have backhoes.
Nope.
They don't have large mechanized ways of piling up dirt. So what they're doing is they're filling up baskets, and people are, in a long kind of a conveyor belt of humans, they are laying down those basket loads one basket at a time. And in some cases, especially when the soil is very clay, you can actually still almost see the basket loads. You can differentiate the basket loads even hundreds and hundreds of years after they were made, and even see in some cases the impressions left by the basket on the actual dirt. And so in a case like that, there's no question, of course, people were making those.
Oh yeah.
And stratigraphically too, when archaeologists dig through a mound, an artificial pile of dirt, that is a pile of dirt that's been put up by people, that stratigraphically, that's very different from something that happens in nature.
Right.
In a couple of cases, I've never seen the Mena Mounds of Washington State up close and personal, but I have seen excavations of them where people have essentially cut one of these things in half. And you can see very clearly they have a very consistent stratigraphy that running a transect through it, the top layer is organically very rich and tends to be very dark, and then there's a lower level of like sandy stuff that's lighter underneath.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's super consistent, and that's typical of natural deposition. Mm-hmm. In the case of burial mounds, what you've had is people are getting dirt from a bunch of different places, mixing it all up and piling it all up. Imagine if you were to, you know, dig a hole in your backyard and pile it up into a mound, even a couple of feet, 3-4 feet high, that all that dirt and all that glacial material, and it's all mixed together. It's a hodgepodge because you're just looking to pile up enough dirt to make a mound in which you can bury somebody. That's very different. When you then come hundreds or even thousands of years later and cut through those, the stratigraphy there, the layering of that soil looks very different from what you see when you dig through something like a Mima mound, where that the stratigraphy there is entirely natural. It's not cultural.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I did get a chance to excavate some actual mounds few years ago, and it was very interesting seeing the stratigraphy. Our soil wasn't clayey enough to preserve the individual basket loads, but that you could tell that the construction of the mound itself had been very, very well planned, because you could see it was almost as if they were using certain types of dirt at different points in the building process. And then there were at least two different periods where they were, we called it preparing the floor, but basically what they had done is they had gotten to the height that they, or the layer that they had wanted to get to. And then it looks like they burned the whole layer and just burned the layer down as a preparation to clear away anything. Or maybe it was some kind of ritual or something, but there were at least two layers of clearly of a burn episode occurring across the entire mound, or at least across the section that we excavated. So that was really interesting. But yeah, sometimes they can just be a bunch of jumbled dirt. Sometimes they're very, very meticulously planned, but you can always tell just looking at the soils that you're in a man-made mound. Whereas with the Mima mounds, how they are usually described is, like you said, they have a very large and dense organic zone.
Right, which is horizon.
Right, which is unusual for the area. And then underneath that A zone, they go almost directly into basically sterile soils. So you're looking at gravels and almost all the way to bedrock immediately, the way they were making it sound.
Right, so. Yeah.
But I like you. I've never actually seen a Mima mound bisected.
But here's the deal. I recommend everybody do this. Get on your computer and go on Google Earth and Google type in Mima mounds, and you'll get the National Monument and the Natural Monument, which is in Washington.
Yeah.
But then keep that on your screen, and then open another screen where you Google the Hopewell Culture National Historic Park. Yeah, I think that's what it's called. And get a nice aerial view of that. And you can compare them side by side with the Hopewell. That is it's about 22 acres enclosed by an earth embankment. And there's a bunch of circular mounds and one nice, beautiful oval-shaped mound. And some of these mounds are single burials and some of them are multiple burials.
Right.
But check, when you look at them side by side, from a very general perspective, well, yeah, they kind of look alike because they're circular. But in fact, it's the cultural ones, the burial mounds, are far more regular in appearance. Now, the Hopewell Culture National Monument there, that has been reconstructed. I think back in the earlier part of the 20th century, that was kind of wiped out, and I believe there was a National Guard encampment there. Uh-huh. But they had lots of photographs, and they were able to reconstruct the mounds.
But it's kind of cool project, wasn't it?
Yeah, I'm not sure, but if you compare them side by side, it's a nice kind of instructive lesson. Where the Mima mounds, it looks like natural packing of lots and lots and lots and lots of these circular piles of earth. Where in the case of Hopewell, they're much more spread out, and there's more diversity in terms of their size and even their shape. So you don't get a nice big oval mound in the Mima mounds. You get a beautiful oval or elliptical mound in the case of the Hopewell Culture National Park, Historical Park.
And that's the difference between a planned mound and a mound that is occurring due to natural processes. So, yeah, you have a much more symmetrical item than you would get if you're just leaving it to natural forces.
Right. And I highly recommend anybody, if you're ever in Ohio, the Hopewell Culture National Historical Park is it's a wonderful place. It's got a great museum and terrific staff there that'll, you know, give you a tour of the place. It's a really interesting, it's a necropolis.
Yeah.
It's a place where obviously this is sacred space in which probably primarily important people were buried. And there's a remains of a structure there where they cremated folks, preparing their bones for burial. Some people were buried that way. Some people, I think, were buried, their whole bodies buried and not burned.
I've visited there. Don't they have one of the mounds so you can walk through it?
Here's the deal about that, Sarah.
Okay.
When I was there, I visited that mound years ago.
Right.
That site years ago. And yep, as you walk through the earth embankment there, on the first mound on your left was a burial mound, which was open. And so there's like a, you know, the folks who maintained it put a door there, and you could actually walk into the mound.
Yeah.
And the human burial and artifacts were left in situ. And if I remember correctly, it was like a plexiglass.
I don't think when I was there that the remains were in situ, but I think they did have kind of like a staged grave goods space.
It's been so long, and I thought whatever. But here's the deal: I think that the last time I was there, which is just a couple of years ago, years ago, that has been completely closed off.
Has it?
So
okay.
That you can't enter into the mound anymore. And I think that was at least in part was done because of the Native Americans who felt that this was it was not the appropriate thing to do at a burial of one of their ancestors.
I am not a huge fan of displaying human remains either. I do not like when museums do it in any way, shape, or form. So
right.
I can totally get behind that.
Yeah, I think if I remember correctly now, at the Kolomoki site, which is down in the southeast, which is a large temple mound, but there's also the museum itself is actually built into the side of a significant, substantial burial mound.
Mm-hmm.
That when you walk to the back of the museum, you actually are walking into the guts of the mound. But I'm pretty sure that the skeletons there are replicas. They're not the actual remains of the people who were buried in the mound.
See, and I don't know why, but like having a replica out doesn't bother me. It's having the actual remains out. That bothers me. It's like, this is right. A person.
Well, I mean, I think that in a case like that, to just get a little bit off topic here.
Yeah. We are a little,
just imagine, right. Just imagine, a burial site for in Washington, D.C., with Arlington National Cemetery, and say, well, let's open up some of those graves so people can see the bones of the soldiers. And I think most people would find that completely out of line.
Right.
Well, it's not that different when you're looking at – it's not different at all. In fact, if you're talking about Native American burials. And I do remember years ago – and this is an apocryphal story. I have no idea if it's true. But I heard – and this is when I was in grad school, so we're talking about – early 1970s, that a group of Native Americans who are graduate students at a university actually wrote a very authentic and legitimate grant proposal to the National Science Foundation to excavate burials in Massachusetts at an old colonial cemetery. This is an established cemetery behind a church that they felt, well, you know, we will dig up the bones, the remains of, you know, Priscilla and John Alden and see what their diets were like. We can study their bones. And they did it. I mean, of course, it was a symbolic protest. And of course, they were turned down because what they were asking was, in fact, illegal.
Although, right, but it's totally
scientifically,
legit,
it was
though.
Totally legit.
Yeah.
But the point that they were making was, well, you know, archaeologists do this all the time. You dig up our ancestors. How come we can't dig up yours?
Right.
And
they made,
I think, a very valuable point.
They did. And I mean, if that proposal had gotten accepted, they would have dug up some really valuable information too. It's all about, for me, having no actual horse in the race, it's all about what you've learned and how respectful you are after the point. Because sometimes you come across, especially when you're doing mound research or you're in an area that is you're expecting to come across a prehistoric civilization. The possibility of running into human remains is always there. Right. And I know a lot of groups, a lot of states require there to be a tribal monitor now, so that this problem doesn't pop up, or when it does pop up, it can be dealt with immediately. But there are situations in a lot of museums where they do display human remains. And I'm not just talking about like Native American human remains. I remember going to a museum in Georgia, and they had a display on Genghis Khan, which was actually really interesting. But as you walked through it, they put up several different they had a small display in the back that had a Mongolian style burial. And they made it very clear that they were actually displaying the skeleton of a woman. And I was just like, I don't think it's appropriate. And I actually talked to them about it. I said, I do not feel like it is appropriate that you are displaying human remains. Like, it would be one thing if you're like, this is a fake skeleton and we've repositioned it in the way that it would have been found in the burial. That's different than saying, no, we're actually just put a dead person there for everybody to come and gawk at. That's exactly what you did.
Hey, listen, Sarah, do yourself a favor and never go to the Muter Museum in Pennsylvania, which is kind of a museum of medical procedures. And there are lots and lots and lots of human skeletons, most of which are the skeletons of people who suffered from severe genetic mutations. So you've got lots of very strange people who obviously had extraordinary challenges in their lives.
Yeah.
And lots of fetal skeletons and all kinds of stuff. So never go there, because those are all legit. Those are all real.
I understand needing that kind of stuff for study purposes as a person in the field. Right. You know,
but this is
you need museum. To learn these things, but
this is a museum for all to go to. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I'm not. I'm that bodies thing that went through, totally against
that's
that.
Not into it.
Yes. Back to the Mima Mounds.
Back to the Mima Mounds. So, Sarah, since you are the director, the chief cook and bottle washer of this, I'm going to ask you to provide the listening audience, with the best common, the best accepted explanation for what the Mima Mounds are, because it's great.
Okay, and I'm going to do that right after we get back from break.
There you go. Because
you are correct. It is.
There's a cliffhanger right
it
there.
It is probably my favorite explanation for anything ever.
Hey everyone, I'm here with Dan Bigman of Bigman Geophysical with an awesome special offer for APN listeners. Dan, what have you got for us?
Well, for the past year, I've been everywhere I've went, people have requested training on ground penetrating radar, and they've all voiced concerns that there's nowhere to get accessible quality training for a really reasonable price. So what Bigman Geophysical is doing is we're going to put on a 3-part webinar series on GPR basics, ground penetrating radar basics, that's going to take place Mondays, April 18th, April 25th, and May 2nd, 2016. In this course, we're going to break it into 3 parts. Part 1 is going to go over basic concepts and theory of ground penetrating radar. Part 2 is going to talk about processing data, visualizing data, and GPR data interpretation. And then part 3 is going to be all about case studies and applications of ground penetrating radar to several different industries, including archaeology.
And how long does each class period last?
So each class period is going to have a live section on Monday. For each of those Mondays, it's going to be about an hour and 15 to an hour and a half of class time. And then there's going to be additional time for question and answers throughout each course. What we're also going to do is do an unlimited replay for each topic for each week from Wednesday to Sunday. So if you miss it or you want to see it again, which we hope you do, then you'll be able to log into a special website and replay the webinar.
And how much is this going to cost us?
So the regular price of this webinar is $299. And what we're going to do for APN listeners as a special deal is give a 25% discount for the first 7 days that we're running registration. So that's going to go from March 7th till March 14th at 8 p.m. Eastern time for that 25% discount. After that, we're still going to give APN listeners a discount that's just for them. It's going to be 10%. But if you really want to get in this for relatively inexpensive, then the 25% off is going to give you a rate of $225 for the course.
So where can people go to sign up for this class?
They just have to pop over to bigmangeophysical.com/APN to get the special rate. That's bigmangeophysical.com/APN. And there they can sign up and go to a secure website to enter all their information and get that 25% off.
So whether you're a seasoned archaeologist or just getting started, this course will really be an asset for everyone. Head over to bigmangeophysical.com/APN, or you can click through from the APN website at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com to get your 25% off today.
And we're back.
And Sarah, we left our listeners
with
a cliffhanger.
So
how these meme mounds, these bizarre things that they're all looking at now on Google Earth, what made those circular piles of dirt?
Well, I want to tell you that it was aliens because I want everything to be aliens. But it's not. It has a natural explanation that is the most accepted.
So we're not going to see an episode of Ancient Aliens with Giorgio traipsing over the Mima Mounds and saying, aliens.
I actually think there is an episode of Ancient Aliens with somebody traipsing through the Mima Mounds trying to explain aliens. Yeah, I'm pretty sure that was something I came across.
Tell us, the real explanation, I think, is a hell of a lot more interesting, isn't it?
It is, and I love it so much. So the Mima Mounds, the most widely accepted explanation for the creation and maintenance of the Mima Mounds is giant rodents, specifically pocket gophers, who apparently are called that because they have fur-lined pockets in their cheeks. I don't have any idea what they store in those pockets, but
credit cards, keys, wallet,
shovels, apparently. But what these rodents do, and they don't look like they're that big, but they're larger than a regular rodent, is they move dirt towards the center of the mound. So they're constantly refreshing the soil in the center of the mound, which causes the mounds to grow, causes them to get larger and, I assume, wider as well.
Right.
So there is some there's some valid criticism of the idea that the rodents, that the pocket gophers are the ones making the mounds. And one of them is, especially in the Washington area, apparently there are no gophers in the area. So my thought is that doesn't mean they didn't make them. It just means that they're not living there now. They could have had a large population at some point in the past, because in support of this idea, aside from the spacing of the mounds being the proper spacing for pocket gophers, who are apparently don't like each other but don't like to live that far away from each other either, they are also the same size as gopher dens and often coincide with an actual gopher den. So that would be probably the first clue.
There's almost
always a gopher den underneath one of these mounds. One of the ways that they proved this, aside from just observation, was the University of San Jose in California ran a computer model where they put in the specifications that they needed, flat ground, this kind of stuff, these rodents that can move this much dirt in this amount of time, blah, blah, blah. And then they let the model run and sped it up so that they could watch. And they did see that over about 100 years worth of time, their little digital gophers could actually build an exact replica of the Mima Mounds. So they've got some hard computer data that proves that this is probably the best idea, the best theory that we have going.
And that also, that explains that the concentration of dense, very rich, organically rich soil on the top.
Right.
Because you've got gophers bringing food in, gophers pooping all over the place, gophers dying, and that's enriching the soil and making it black. One of the reasons I love that explanation, Sarah, is that way back in the day when when crop circles were really a big deal, there was one of the researchers, and I'll put those in scare quotes, suggested that, in fact, that the crop circles were not alien, were not made by aliens, but they weren't made by people, by pranksters. They were made by, are you ready? Sex-crazed hedgehogs.
Hedgehogs.
And apparently really horny hedgehogs chase after each other and run around in circles. And so somebody said, ah, they're flattening the wheat and flattening the crops because they're, you know, you got males chasing females or females chasing males. And
those are really big hedgehogs.
I guess so. So I'm thinking that the gopher explanation is probably on firmer ground. Like, that's not really intended as a pun or as a double entendre. They're firmer ground than the crazed hedgehogs. One of the things that some folks who are kind of skeptical about the gopher explanation, one of the things they say is, well, maybe the gophers aren't making the mounds, but when the gophers move to an area where there are mounds, they take advantage of these already naturally made features because they're well drained. They're up high, you know, that they,
yeah.
So in other words, the claim is that maybe they're, yeah, maybe we find gopher dens in the mounds, but not because they're making the mounds, but because they seek out these mounds.
Well, they're using an opportunist. They're opportunists.
Yeah.
They're using something that already exists as right. their habitat.
So, I mean, we have to admit, you know, nobody knows absolutely for sure, certain. But, you know, when you look at the aerial photograph and you start looking at all those mounds and how they are packed almost perfectly geometrically together, it does look like an entirely natural phenomenon. They're not spacing these things out. These things are packed in exactly as you would expect nature to do.
Yeah, there's a lot of... I feel like there is a lot of evidence supporting the gopher theory. and there are other theories that are up for consideration. There's one of them is a lot of the areas experience vernal flooding, which is flooding that occurs in the spring and the early right. part of the summer.
We have vernal pools all over the place here in the Northeast. Yeah.
Yeah. And what happens for people who don't know what this is, the area basically floods due to the rains and the high water table, I assume, in the area. And then as it gets warmer, they dry up and go away until the rains the next year. Right. This in areas where this is a phenomena, it does create an interesting landscape, especially in wetland and lowland areas. Uh-huh. But I don't feel like... I feel like, actually, I think my favorite thing for the Mima is... a combination of everything. I think it's a combination of gophers digging burrows and the flooding, the seasonal flooding. And then another one of the theories is that it's just a natural process caused by basically erosion and mechanical weathering. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of blowing and accumulation. Because if you've ever been out in the woods, anybody, if you've ever been out in the woods, especially in like a windy time, you'll notice that drifts occur around raised areas, not just trees, but if there's already a berm, that berm's going to accumulate leaves and debris and snow on one side more than the other because it creates a natural windbreak and things accumulate when they run out of wind to keep them moving. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the theories behind it growing. And that also would account for the thick... A horizon on it. So I think it's a combination of everything. I think once those mounds got built, I think the gophers maybe started the process because they're spaced properly. There's almost always a gopher hole. There are currently gophers living in a lot of them. So I think once the gophers got it going, then the other natural processes just kind of took advantage of it. And so I think they're being built and maintained through a combination of all of these processes.
Right.
I don't think it's one thing, basically.
Right. And the thing, too, these Mima mounds, there are so many of them. They're circular, so they appear to be sort of that's artificial, what creates circles in nature.
Right.
But they're one of a vast number of natural features that, to the untrained eye, look too regular, too patterned, or too consistent to be natural.
Yes.
But we have, here in the Northeast, we have mounds that are called moulins, M-O-U-L-I-N, or moulin kames. And they are, we do not have conical mounds artificial mounds. We don't have burial mounds in Connecticut. But you can drive across an ancient glacial landscape and see mounds that are circular at the base, that are in some cases pretty substantially sized, 10, 20, or 30 feet high, and kind of conical in cross-section. Mm-hmm. And they are, in fact, glacial features.
Yeah.
And what's cool is that you can go to areas that today are glaciated and where the glaciers are melting, and you can see these streams. These appear to be small brooks, streams, or even medium-sized rivers that are flowing across the top of the ice.
Yeah.
And actually, they end up eroding what are waterfalls and cascades into the ice. And since these rivers are – glaciers are not just big ice cubes. They're not static things. They are – there's rock on them. There's soil on them. There's all this junk that they've pulled up as they've scoured the area underneath, and it's been mixed around in the ice. And so when these rivers flow on the tops of glaciers and flow down to their bases, they bring with them sediment.
Yes.
Rocks and essentially glacial moraine. And when that happens, the glacier melts out, this stuff piles up at the bottom of these cascades or waterfalls. And when the whole glacier melts away, what's left behind is a mound. Mm-hmm. But again, if you excavate that mound, it doesn't look anything like a human-made burial mound. It looks like a big pile of glacial debris, of glacial moraine, with lots of cobbles and rounded cobbles because they've all been spun around at the bottom of the glacier or spun around in the stream. But if you drive by one of these things, and there's one not that far from where I live, if you didn't know what the glacial process was for producing these, you'd look at that and say, my, that looks like a burial mound.
Right.
But in fact, the geologists have gone through and they've cored the thing. And it very clearly is this glacial feature called a moulin, or moulin cave. And they're cool, but it's part of it's don't misunderstand here. When you see features in the natural world that are patterned or consistent, that doesn't mean human beings played a role in making them. And that's actually a common mistake made by some of the folks, the ancient astronauts people and the Atlantis people, who see natural features. They think that, well, they're so patterned, they're so regular, they're so consistent, that couldn't be nature. It must have been produced by humans. But in fact, there are natural processes that produce patterned features all of the time. And moulin caves are one of them. These Mima mounds are another.
Bosnian pyramids.
But yeah, at that time we talked about the Bosnian pyramids, where simply because a mountain has what appear to be kind of regular angles to it, that's absolutely doesn't mean anything, because nature does that all the time. My favorite example of that, and maybe I mentioned it previously, is in California. There's a national monument. It's called the Devil's Postpile National Monument. And it's absolutely not natural. If you've ever heard of the Giant's Causeway in Ireland, it's exactly the same geological process that produced it. These are large columns of basalt. Basalt is a volcanic rock. So this was igneous. It was molten. And certain basalts, when they solidify in regularly shaped columns.
Yes.
And the ones in Devil's Postpile, I think they're hexagonal. Yeah, I'm pretty sure they're hexagonal. And when you walk the trail at Devil's Postpile, the first part of the trail, you're walking along the edge of that cliff, and you can see these amazing, very, very lengthy columns that look very regular, and all they are, it's almost like crystals. It's like the growth of huge basalt crystals.
Well, that's basically what they are.
Yeah. And the cool thing is when you get to the very top of the trail, you are walking on the tops of those columns.
Oh, cool.
And they all sit together like little hexagonal pavers. I've got a photograph. I think it's in my frauds book, but I show it in class all the time. I have a photograph of the top of that because I hiked there, hiked to the top. And so you've got this very regular shape. They look like hexagonal pavers, like you would find in a cityscape. And right next to it, I have a photograph of the street, the sidewalk, right across from the American Museum of Natural History in Manhattan, where in fact they use these black, I don't know if they're asphalt or stone pavers on that walkway, and they look very, very similar. But yeah. In one case, you've got a completely natural process, and in the other, you have obviously architectural elements of the sidewalk. But it's really cool that they look very similar. When you look more closely, you can see that, yeah, nature has produced something that human beings have produced as well. That's a big issue in there have been for years now. There are folks who are who dive in the area around Bimini, and they have found what some people have claimed to be either a road, you know, this is submarine, this is under water,
yeah,
a road or a wall, and they call it the Bimini Wall.
Yeah,
it's part of the lost continent of Atlantis.
Yeah.
I've spoken to geologists who actually have dived on that and have investigated that. And they say, no, it's this incredibly cool geological feature called tessellated pavement, in which rocks underwater, especially volcanic rocks, when they solidify in these kind of regular shapes with intersections between them. So it looks like you've got, you know, individual large, almost cyclopean walls, like the walls of the Inca that the Inca built. But in fact, it's entirely natural. You can see the same thing on a beach in Tasmania. Again, if you go and Google tessellated pavement, and you'll see these amazing surfaces on beaches. Now, these are areas are now exposed, so you can actually walk over them. And especially if you look at small sections of it, it looks absolutely artificial. But then when you look at it from a grander scale, you see, wow, nature is capable of producing some amazing looking stuff that's entirely natural, but that looks very patterned, very consistent, very regular.
Well, I think this is part of people not understanding how, I mean, this is not entirely off topic, but people not understanding how rock forms, and that rock is basically, I mean, people understand crystals, especially a lot of people believe in this kind of stuff. And so they understand that crystals grow in very regular formations, and they have, like, salt is a crystal, and it has a shape, and all crystals, different types of crystals have different types of shapes. And rock is basically the same thing. I mean, I think it literally is the exact same thing. And so when rock forms, it can form these regular crystalline shapes as well. And so if you can accept that a crystal can grow naturally in a regular shape, you should also be able to accept that rock itself can do that.
And on a larger scale than you're used to seeing.
A much larger scale.
Crystals, they think of these little tiny things.
Right.
But in the case of the Devil's Postpile, in case of Giant's Causeway,
you're looking at a much
larger scaled kind of feature, but again, it's this very regular, very patterned, and very consistent.
Yeah, and it does. I mean, I'm looking at pictures of them right now. They do look very, to an untrained eye, they do look very man-made, especially when you think of things like megaliths, prehistoric megaliths and such, where it's regular, but it's very rough looking. So yeah, if you have that in mind when you're looking at these things, then yeah, you're going to instantly see, oh, lost civilization. But that's not what you're looking
at. But here's, you want the funniest application of that, Sarah, is from our good buddy Eric von Däniken. Now, I can't remember which of his books this appears, but there's an island in the Pacific called Nan Maedol, N-A-N, second word, M-A-D-O-L. And that island, it's a volcanic island, and the processes, the geological features that we're talking about here for Giant's Causeway and for Devil's Postpile National Monument were in play here on Nan Maedol. Here's a really cool thing. The local people actually quarried these large columns of basalt out of a natural quarry, and they used them to produce buildings.
Yeah.
The buildings, essentially using these columns like you would use logs.
Yeah,
they to make a log cool. house. And it's incredibly cool. And yeah, they're really heavy, and they probably would have been difficult to move, but they were certainly capable of doing that. When von Däniken, now I'm going to to, I can't quote von Däniken, I'm going to paraphrase him here, but I remember very clearly von Däniken describing these features, these logs at Nan Maydal, and suggesting that they had been cut with lasers.
Oh, yeah.
Which, of course, is absolutely absurd. Now, it's really cool that these people looked at, they didn't have a lot of trees on their island, but they had a lot of basalt columns. They said, you know what? We could use these as architectural elements. We could use these as raw material to build very, very sturdy structures. And that's exactly what they did. Mm-hmm. You never underestimate the capability of people to take advantage of, to exploit their natural surroundings, to move really heavy stuff, and to figure out challenges like, well, how do we quarry these? How do we move them? And so, again, it's incredibly cool natural features that look very patterned, but that are entirely natural and people using them as such.
Well, if you think about it, though, if you're living in an area where you have these perfect basalt columns, I mean, I'm looking at pictures of them. They're beautiful. Why wouldn't you use them? They break away from each other probably fairly easily.
Right.
You probably could just with a couple little blows pull them apart, and then all you've got to do is figure out how to cart these things to wherever you're getting them. Why wouldn't you use them?
Yeah, you would think. I'm pretty sure that these things clearly, if you hit them in the right way, they're going to break along those planes in between the individual columns.
Well, I mean, they do it naturally, so surely.
Right. Exactly. We don't have, in Connecticut, we do not have that kind of feature, but we have some really cool basalt. And there's a hike I always take with my field school students up to the top of Talcott Mountain, which is in Connecticut. A mountain can be like 900 feet tall. It's not like really a mountain. But at the top, there's this beautiful geological exposure where you've got these, they're not columns. They're more like prismatic shapes of prismatic columns of basalt coming out of the mountain. And they're not nearly as regularly shaped as what we were talking about here. But again, it's, you know, pretty cool. There's some consistency to them. And again, it's entirely natural.
Let's take a quick break.
Sure.
And when we come back, we will kind of dive back into the Mima Mounds and wrap this up.
The CRM Archaeology Podcast brings together a panel of cultural resource management professionals to discuss the issues that really matter to the profession. Find out about networking strategies, job hunting, graduate programs, and much more. We'll often feature interviews with college professors, CRM business owners, and experts as well. Check out the show on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, and at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/CRM Arc Podcast. Let's get back to the show.
So we are back and we are wrapping up our talk about the Mima Mounds that were created by giant rodents. And yes, you heard that come away from this podcast.
But not extraterrestrial rodents.
No, earthbound.
Good American rodents.
So there is a couple things about the giant rodent thing and the Mima Mound thing. Apparently, like I said earlier, the Mima Mound phenomena happens all over the world. In Africa, I believe they have things called fairy rings, which I have no idea why you would call them that in Africa, because I didn't think any of those cultures there have any concept of fairies.
Yeah, but you know, there are a whole lot of Europeans moved into Africa during the colonial, as a result of colonialism, and so maybe that term derives from them.
Well, and I believe it's in Mexico where they call them pimple mounds, so take that how you want.
Yeah, pimple does not sound really appetizing.
No, why? Yeah, it'd be terrifying.
Can you jump up and down on one of them and
ew,
pop it?
Stop.
All right, ew. Never mind.
Too much. Too far. but so,
I do recommend everybody look up Google. Go to Google and look up images of pocket gophers, because they're kind of adorable.
They really are, and they're not as giant as I'm making them sound. But I do like just saying that's giant rodents. But So these do happen in other parts of the world, and they're not always necessarily associated with pocket gophers, because apparently they do exist in other places besides North America. But the argument has been made that other burrowing rodents similar to a gopher would also be making, or just another kind of gopher might be making these similar mounds, because they're not identically placed. Like the Mima Mounds in Washington, the placement of the mounds is very specific. I'm going to guess that the African fairy rings are more round, more ring-shaped, hence the name. So, you know, different types of gophers are going to create different types of neighborhoods, basically. So that's probably what we're looking at here.
But then again, if you look up pocket gopher, along with seeing pictures of pocket gophers, you'll see photographs as well of their towns. And sure enough, there are these little round mounds peppering the landscape.
Yeah.
Now, whether they are exactly the same, we don't want to make the same mistake we accuse other people of making, that two things that kind of look similar, you know, when you squint, are necessarily the same thing and have the same etiology. But at least there's a possibility that we're looking at the same kinds of things.
Well, and we have more than just squinting at the images of their towns. Yeah, yeah. I mean, we have data to back up these claims. They really are adorable.
In one of these photographs that I'm seeing, it's like it's circular areas where there's no vegetation. The vegetation is all around it. So something is obviously wiping out the vegetation in these kind of circular patterns. But in one of these, it looks like an actual ring of vegetation.
Oh, yeah. These don't look anything like those.
No, uh-uh.
Oh. Okay, ignore the African fairy ring thing. Apparently,
let's not ignore them. They're incredibly cool.
They are cool looking, but they are not mounds. They are literally died-off rings of vegetation.
Yeah, exactly.
Huh. Wonder what causes that. Could be gophers.
But all I know is if you look carefully enough, you find National Geographic talking about it. New theory explains Africa's mysterious fairy rings.
Can we just take a minute? Because I don't believe we can trust National Geographic anymore. And I hate saying that.
It's sadness, isn't it?
They have drank the Kool-Aid and they're no longer reliable, in my opinion. If you choose to accept them as a knowledgeable source, then I can do nothing for you. But
well, I think at this point also we have to distinguish the magazine itself from the research that they fund from the stuff that they put on TV.
And that's the part that kills me, because they do, at least they have in the past, funded real research and real expeditions and real data collection. And then they put like trash pickers on their channel. So, yeah, I don't know.
Well, it's also the case that Rupert Murdoch has purchased National Geographic.
That explains everything. Right?
So that's, yes. So that's that. There's a problem right there. Although I don't know how much impact he has on the content of the magazine. When he bought it out, I think the larger concern was what he was going to do with their various incarnations on cable. So yes, so Mima Mounds are incredibly cool, but they're incredibly natural.
They are.
And it's, you know, it's really okay that we have things like the Mima Mounds where we walk away from it going, well, we think we know what the source here is, but we're not exactly sure. And just because there are similar things elsewhere in the world doesn't mean they have the same explanation.
This is true.
And that what science is all about is being open to new ideas and new explanations. So, I mean, if you want to say, oh no, the Mima Mounds are, you know, were built by guys from Atlantis, or it's burial mounds in Washington, or it's ancient astronauts. Well, that's a perfectly decent, I won't say it's a perfectly decent hypothesis, but I'll say, well, it's a hypothesis. And that can be very easily tested. And people have excavated these things. They're not cultural. They're entirely natural. And we're just still not exactly sure what the natural cause is.
No, and like you were saying, it could be different things in different areas. Like what makes them,
right?
What makes them in one area probably might or may not be the thing that makes them in another area. They're just getting a similar result.
Right. It reminds me a little bit of those. Where is it? Is it somewhere in the Nevada where the rocks move by themselves.
Oh yeah, from the ice. There's like an icing thing that happens.
Is that what it is? And I the think wind so. Blows and the Death rocks Valley. Leave trails.
Yeah.
That's another really cool thing, and geologists have to deal with that more than archaeologists, where it's like, this is a really interesting phenomenon and we're not exactly sure what causes it. And people have looked for years, and now they've actually come up with a pretty good model for how nature can move rocks.
Yeah.
At least move rocks in the desert. In glaciated areas, it's easy. Ice can move rocks. But in this case, it's a combination of kind of really super reducing the friction on the surface, and with enough wind, you can blow stuff.
Yeah, I've seen them recreate that situation. And it is. It is pretty amazing to watch.
It's really cool.
Because it's like, that's not going to really work. And then it does work. And then you're like, ooh.
Yeah. The world is full of really cool stuff, geologically and archaeologically. And we're always open to new explanations. But, you know, we're just demanding of evidence.
Exactly. As scientists, which, believe it or not, archaeologists actually are, when we are confronted with something like the Mima Mounds, the first thing we did was cut one open. And once we did that, we realized they were not man-made. And then we started looking for other solutions to the problem as opposed to just jumping to aliens.
Exactly, yes. So. I'm glad you said we cut one of the mounds open and not one of those adorable pocket gophers.
So, funny story. It's just so many things I've chopped through by digging shovel test pits. I'm not going to say they didn't cut one of the poor little gophers open in the process, but probably it was smart enough to get out of the way when it heard everybody tromping up towards its little hole. So
yes. Well, talking of giant rodents, we have in Connecticut, we have woodchucks.
Yes.
Woodchucks. And woodchucks are, you know,
they really are giant,
like Punxsutawney Phil or whatever. Right. But anyhow, the state archaeologist of Connecticut, who at the time was Doug Jordan, lovely man, is now passed away. He had a lot of contacts with our amateur archaeologists, and a local landowner in South Windsor called up Doug and said, "Well, I'm walking around these big gopher holes that we've got, these big woodchuck holes, and in the back dirt of some of these woodchuck holes, he found spear points."
Nice.
And of course, we joked that, "Oh my God, they've learned to make stone tools." The woodchucks, now we're screwed because we live in areas where there are woodchucks, and if they're armed, it's going to be trouble. What happened, of course, was that the woodchucks had accidentally and coincidentally had dug through like a 3,600-year-old late archaic site in central Connecticut, along the Connecticut River. And we called it Woodchuck Knoll because, nice, in fact, the knoll where the site was, under which the site was located, was a little bit higher and a little bit drier. So when the river flooded, that knoll stayed dry on top. And in fact, so people have been using that for millennia. And the woodchucks liked it because it was a little bit drier. They dug through and up popped spear points. So what we did was, We isolated the area. We set up an excavation grid, and we, in fact, in one case, actually dug through like a woodchuck town, because the site, in fact, they were in the heart of the site. So at the end of the field season, and you, Sarah, I know you guys you've seen this, you've done this, where at the end of the field season, you know, you have a big party, and maybe somebody makes shirts for everybody to wear.
Nice.
And somewhere I've got this ratty old shirt that says Woodchuck Knoll, you know, field season 1978 or whatever. And the image on the shirt is of a woodchuck holding a spear with a hafted stone point.
Hey, you know, when they finally figure it out, we are doomed. They are very large animals.
Yeah, they're large, and yeah, if they get weapons, we are kind of screwed.
We're screwed. So actually, it's good that you brought that up, because eventually one of these pocket guys is going to pop up with some kind of artifact. And they're eventually going to dig far enough that they'll come up with something.
Right, exactly. Because
animals, burrowing animals and tree falls are both a bane and the blessing of every archaeological site ever. So, yeah, I mean, things to keep in mind if you're walking by and you see a rodent burrow and you see stuff outside the rodent burrow, probably they're not arming themselves, but you may want to give your state archaeologist a call.
Yeah, but how about this? I was excavating a site that was like 2,000-year-old site with pottery, the whole deal. And at the same level of the occupation level where we were finding ceramics, we found a beer bottle.
Yep.
And when we looked really carefully at the profile, what had happened was it was a woodchuck burrow that had gone through the site, and that at some point some farmer threw a beer bottle in and then filled in the hole.
Yeah.
Because he didn't want to get his tractor to get stuck or one of the cows to break a leg by falling in it. And it had been packed down for probably a couple of hundred years, especially if this was just the guy that wouldn't have filled it with his tractor.
Right.
But so it was difficult to see. It had been packed down, so it was so dense. But very clearly, that was an instance in which either, again, you know, people 2,000 years ago had Budweiser beer, or, you know, some... obviously we had not been careful enough in looking at the stratigraphy.
The stratigraphy is important there, but you get that more than people think you do. And that's why a lot of times when people tell me, oh, well, they found this artifact at the same level that they were finding, you know, ancient spear points and stuff, you know, and they'll try to throw that at me as evidence. I'm just like, yeah, I don't doubt for a minute that they were. Because animals do that, or you know, fox burrows. Fox like to dig and burrow as well. So do rabbits. And when farmers come across these things, very often they will fill the holes in an attempt to get rid of the animals. And
they'll mixes up the stratigraphy.
Yeah, and absolutely. They'll fill it up with whatever is available. And a lot of times it's just topsoil from around the area. And if you've ever driven down a country road, or walked along a field near a country road, there is a lot of modern trash that just gets shoved down into that hole. Or fill it with modern trash, you know, it just becomes the trash hole.
But you know what? It's also the case, not only does nature do that, but people do it.
Yeah.
So that if you can have a 4,000-year-old site and people move back to this same spot 2,000 years later, and when they're digging their trash pits or digging their burials, they can encounter ancient sites, and then stuff gets all mixed together, and you have 2,000-year-old artifacts, stylistically 2,000-year-old artifacts, stylistically 4,000-year-old artifacts, side by side, or even where the stratigraphy is reversed.
Yeah.
So that you look at, you have the 2,000-year-old artifact that is actually, in terms of just depth, is below the 4,000-year-old artifact.
Yeah, and most of the times you can see that in the stratigraphy, so you know what you're dealing with. But
right.
Yeah, when those kind of situations happen, archaeologists don't immediately assume time travel; they assume bioturbation.
But it absolutely is a reason why archaeologists try to be assiduously careful when we look at that. It's why we're so obsessed about keeping those stratigraphic profiles clean, so we can see where that kind of stuff happened, where you've got intrusive pits, where you've got a mixed up stratigraphy, where obviously something has dug down into that and flipped the stuff.
Yeah.
You just gotta be careful.
It's also why we sharpen our trowels. So
absolutely.
Little known fact. Actually, it's not that little known, but archaeologists do sharpen their trowels.
Very much like blades.
So, final thoughts, Ken?
Sarah, I think that again, the general theme here, if everybody is, look, you know, you just, nature produces things on that can look pretty damn patterned.
Yeah.
They look at first glance maybe that it's not natural, but you just have to look more deeply into any of these features to determine whether or not a person made it, or it was in fact the result of some natural geological process or biological process.
And we as humans, we're pattern seekers. It's just how we're programmed. That's what we do. So you're going to see a pattern where there isn't one. So that just means you have to look even harder, because you can get past it, but you have to look.
And nature isn't random. Nature isn't, you know, there are, look at a snowflake.
For
right?
Sure. Fractals occur in nature.
Yeah.
So.
Cool.
All right, man. Thanks.
Been great, Sarah. And we'll talk to you next time.
Yeah. See you then. Trials as one will call. No, it don't do a dinosaur. Thanks for listening. We hope you've enjoyed it. Our music was provided by Archaeosuit Productions. If you like what you've heard, please subscribe and rate us on iTunes or Stitcher and share us wherever you use social media. You can contact us with your questions, comments, or angry email at archaeofantasies@gmail.com. You can follow the podcast at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/archaeofantasies. You can follow the blog at www.archaeofantasies.com and get updates on Tumblr and Twitter at Archy Fantasies. You can also look for us on Facebook. If you're looking for the show notes for this episode, go to the podcast website at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/archaeofantasies. Thanks again for listening.
No, we don't do dinosaurs. No, we don't do dinosaurs. We don't do dinosaurs.
This show is produced by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle and was edited by Chris Webster.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.